Yes. Well, the way we started the Connect was I had this idea, let me teach criminals or drug dealers or just people that are maybe not criminals, but they're breaking the law at that moment, how to not get caught, how to get out of trouble. What, I don't know if you're allowed to talk about this, but what can somebody who's committing crime do to prepare for their inevitable arrest, and how do they mitigate, their sentence?
Right. So I can't tell people how to,
right,
but I can share a couple stories.
Yes, please.
So I did a writ of habeas corpus to get a new trial. The background is client and his crimeys. I don't like when DA say crimey. Mm. I don't really like that. I say co-D, mm-hmm. co-defendants. Mm-hmm. So they have cell phone tower evidence that puts them driving from South Central up to Pasadena, and it's a bank robbery. So the guy's pretty sophisticated. He had a pail full of ice, you know, for the red dye on the money.
Yeah.
So you put that in the ice, apparently. He did time, so they kind of schooled him. Yeah. But one of the guys jumps over the counter, and he left his cell phone on the counter at the scene of the bank robbery.
They brought their cell phones to a bank robbery?
Right. Remember I said the cell phone tower shows them driving from South Central up to Pasadena. So when the cops got to the crime scene, they found all the contacts and they put together the criminal network very handily.
Right.
Then they had the cell phone towers. So the issue on the writ was, how accurate is cell phone tower location evidence? Now, I've got a great expert. I guess I'll put his name out there because he won't take just any case. His name is Mike Cherry. He's from Bell Laboratories. Just a super genius.
Yeah.
And so we had a declaration saying that the closest cell tower is not necessarily the tower that gets the call, which is in some cases something I'll litigate. So in that case, I filed that, and I think it got denied. But again, that's an example, you know, leaving a cell phone at the crime scene. It was a tremendous boon for law enforcement.
Sure.
We talked a little bit about Perkins operations and Mirandized statements. Mm. So the less you say, the better.
Yeah.
Snitches. I think that's pretty obvious.
Do they need the cell phone tower pinging? If, say, a bank robbers or people that are committing a murder are using track phones, there's nothing to trace them. Their name isn't connected to their phone. They just walked into a 7-Eleven and bought a burner phone with some minutes on it. Is there any way for cops to trace that back to them?
So the answer is potentially yes. And to answer this, I need to explain, which is a hot topic, something called a geofence warrant and what that yields. So a geofence warrant is, let's say there's a crime scene, we'll just call it First and Main, right? I think First and Main is where the LA chief of police is. Mm. But let's say there's a shooting in front of the building, but it's a crowded area, right? There's pedestrians, there's cars. But what the cops can do is tell Google, here's our four latitude and longitude points, and we want you to give us every phone number for the relevant time period that's within that square. So that's called a geofence.
And they go to Google to request that, right?
Correct. And then Google gives them phone numbers that are anonymized, so that they're not infringing on the rights of everybody. But what ends up happening is Google ends up, so the cops then investigate, and then they say, okay, I've got these three numbers. I think it's him, et cetera, whatever it is. Then they can go back to Google with another warrant, and then they can get subscriber information.
Wow.
That's for subscribers. Right. Now, for what you call the track phone,
bat phone, burner phone.
Well, I call them burners. Mm-hmm. So they can go to the burner and probably figure out where it was purchased.
Right. And so then they go grab that surveillance footage.
Right. But they need to do that quick, because video disappears usually up to 30 days.
Oh, interesting. So that's not stored in the cloud somewhere? That's for public surveillance?
So my answer is when I try to get video after 30 days, a lot of the times I hear that it's been erased. Oh. But let me give you more to the story, and we'll talk about something called timing advance.
Okay.
This is a good one. You're going to like this. Okay. Timing advance. So everyone knows when I'm on the phone, my cell phone is talking to a tower, right? Cell site tower. And they can show when the call started, which tower, what numbers are involved, et cetera. But what you might not know is even if you're not on your phone, you're not texting, your phone is sitting idle, that your phone is sending a signal to a nearby tower saying, hi guys, here I am. Mm-hmm. And that's how the phone is trying to figure out if you make a call, where to go.
Mm-hmm.
So the time that it takes for the signal to reach the tower and then come back, that is called timing advance. Now that gives more precise location data. So what it looks like is, here's your cell tower. It looks like a clown smile. Mm-hmm. So in other words, we know you're so many feet away from the tower, so you must be somewhere along this radius.
Right.
And it looks like a clown because there's a margin of error.
Mm.
So that's if your cell phone is not, you're not on your phone. Mm.
I met a guy, used to sit at the chow hall with him. He had killed an old woman. He was, addicted, strung out. He was robbing an old lady in her house and he ended up killing her. He turned his cell phone off, put it in his backpack, went and just threw the backpack into a dumpster somewhere. And they were able to turn his cell phone back on. That's a thing. This was back in 2010,
mm-hmm.
2007, actually.
Right.
Have you seen tricks like that? The cops, I mean, is it true that they can hear you with a smartphone? Even if my phone's turned off, they can listen in?
So that one, I have not had a case where that came about, mm-hmm. but I do have sort of an eerie, make you concerned and paranoid.
Yeah.
There's something called the stingray. What the stingray does is that it's similar in concept to the geofence warrant, but now you've got a box and you've got your black box. And if you put it in a location, it will trick every cell phone into thinking it's a tower.
Mm-hmm.
So this thing can suck up
right.
every phone number in a region.
Without a warrant.
Right.
Now, if you had a stingray, if say you were working, you had a murder case, something like a stingray that grabs your client's number, mm-hmm. would you try to suppress that? Or would you try to argue constitutional privacy violations to try to suppress that evidence?
So the answer is actually very interesting. The manufacturer of the Stingray is called Harris Corporation. Mm. And the technology is basically like anti-terrorist level.
Right.
And if a law enforcement officer is in, let's say, a motion to suppress, and I ask the question, was a Stingray device used at any point in this investigation? Harris Corporation makes every agency sign that they will not let them answer that. So what happens is we can then make a motion to dismiss the case because they won't answer. And judges sometimes do.
Wow.
So the prosecutors protect that technology at that level. Now, we talked about a case I did for Danny Pena, and we were convinced that the way they found his prison phone was through a stingray.
Mm.
So I started doing discovery requests. Discovery requests right. means I'm asking for evidence.
Right.
So this is funny. I did a subpoena from the Ventura County Board of Supervisors, and I proved that they bought a stingray. I proved that they paid $130,000 for it. And when I asked for discovery on whether it was used, the prosecutor and the main cop did an evidentiary privilege motion where they basically went in the back with the judge and they said, Your Honor, this is part of an ongoing investigation. You can't give Rosenberg the evidence that he seeks.
How is that legal?
Well, I don't know what they said, right? It's in camera. Right. It's under seal.
Right.
But so prosecutors have advantages like that, that we don't.
Okay. So I that boggles my mind that you have the right to know what you're supposed to have the right to know mm-hmm. what your, the state or the federal government that's trying to incarcerate you. You have the right to know that evidence, but apparently you don't have complete right to do that. What kind of, you know, obviously, like with the mandatory minimum, the bad 90s and 2000s, where you've seen mandatory minimums give complete control to prosecutors. A lot of prosecutors now we know have withheld evidence that would have exonerated people on trial for murder, death row. What has been your experience? Have you seen this? Have you seen this kind of corruption or, in prosecutors that you've gone up against?
Sure. So let me say something about what we call Brady evidence, mm-hmm. and then I'll tell you a trial story.
Yeah.
So Brady evidence is from a case called Maryland versus Brady. And what it says is that the prosecution has a duty to furnish defense with exculpatory evidence. Exculpatory means tends to prove innocence mm-hmm. versus inculpatory tending to prove guilt. So some of the case law says, even if the prosecutor doesn't have it, if the cops have it, they have a duty to turn it over. So in the context of police personnel files, the LA County DA operates a database. It's called the ORWITS database, ORWITS. And what it is that basically if they have heard that it's a dirty cop, they have to tell us about it as a Brady disclosure. Otherwise, we can ask for a reversal.
Wow.
So in many of my, especially, I don't want to say the wrong thing because, you know, I work with a lot of the stations, but there are stations where basically it's like every cop I get a notification that there's excessive force,
right.
There's discipline, there's this and there's that, right?
Yeah.
So when I get that, now I have to do what we call a Pitches motion, which is named after the case that said defense has the right to examine the personnel files upon a showing of materiality and relevance to a low standard. I could talk more about that. But let me tell you the trial story. So the trial story, remember when we talked about the case from Pomona where I got the mistrial motion granted, Neil Del Rio,
right.
The case that got published. So the district attorney at the time had the ORWITS database, but through my own channels, I found out that that detective had a lawsuit against it. So I basically did my own research, but the DA never told me. So I was in New York at the time and I'm writing this motion where I basically said that the prosecutor had a duty to disclose that and he did not. And there are circumstances under which that can be a felony. So I wrote a motion
a felony against
withholding exculpatory wow. evidence on the part of a prosecutor.
And a prosecutor can be charged in theory with a right. felony.
So I made that motion.
Wow.
So talk about that. Right?
Holy shit. Now, is that just a California law that if a cop who's presenting the evidence is dirty, has a bunch of write-ups, they have to let the defense know? Is that just a California thing?
There's a companion case called Henthorn, Henthorn, mm-hmm. and it parallels the Pitches concept for the feds. So you can do right. a police personnel file motion upon a showing that there's misconduct in this case, and therefore you trigger, we would say, an in-camera review. In-camera review means in the judge's office, not in open court where defense is.
Right.
Right. So they go through and they might say, hey, look, John Doe accused and sued cop number one for excessive force, fabrication of evidence, mm-hmm. false police reports, etc. And now the judge, I'm going to order that information be turned over to Rosenberg, and then he can investigate and maybe call that witness at trial.
Right. Did you ever call out a prosecutor, or did you ever have a case get dismissed because of potential Brady violations by the prosecutor who withheld exculpatory evidence?
So the answer is, this comes up mostly in the context of post-conviction relief. And you mentioned it for exonerees.
Right.
So there was, I forget the name, but in Tulare County, the district attorney, there's a case called Satterson, and the guy, Phil Klein, was the district attorney, right? And in his past, he had a Brady exculpatory evidence case where they found it and he had to step down.
Wow.
The same thing happened to, I believe his name is Chief Earl Sanders in San Francisco Police Department. So there was a case when he was a homicide detective, and Jeff Adachi, who I mentioned earlier, was the one who found out that his client did 13 years and was wrongfully convicted because Earl Sanders and his partner had information about a witness who identified somebody else, but they buried it.
Wow. So what happened?
So what happened is the guy got out and Jeff got him out after 13 years.
Do you think prosecutors act this way because why do they do that? Why, if you really believe in the law, if you believe you're doing a public service by being a prosecuting attorney for the state or the feds, if they find evidence that says that person is actually innocent, why do they proceed to try to prosecute? Is it because they're so evil? Is it their ego? They don't want to lose? Are they just bad people? Are they racist? What's your take on that?
So my answer, I'm going to do it by analogy, and then I'll flesh it out for you.
Sure.
Who's my ideal judge, right?
Lance Ito.
Well,
OJ walked.
Actually, Lance Ito did give me a credit for time served on a 5-year offer case once at CCB.
Really?
Yeah.
Dude, Ito's a G, dude.
Yeah, but his brother
is soft on crime.
His brother, on the other hand, is not, but he'll yell at DA, so we like him too.
Right.
Okay, here's my ideal judge. And I don't want to get, don't accuse me of being racist.
Okay.
My ideal judge is an older, white, former prosecutor who practiced in the DA's office a long time ago when they had ethics and higher standards. And so those are the judges that have the courage to say, get Rosenberg an offer now.
Right.
Because they're not worried about the prosecutor running a judge against them to unseat them. They're comfortable with their power.
Interesting.
So that type of judge is the one that I've gotten the most out of, because they're not afraid to use their power. They're not worried. They've been a judge up there forever. They're an incumbent. And so they don't have to play that kind of politics.
Right, because judges get elected.
Correct.
So a new judge might be worried, just like a new politician, he's worried about getting reelected. Mm-hmm. So a new judge might be more favorable to the prosecution because he wants to look tough on crime for the next election.
In addition to that, we tend to say former public defenders and former defense lawyers are not good judges.
Really?
Because they have to overcompensate and try to look tough on crime for that same reason. Now in the feds, so for federal judges, it's very different. First of all, they're appointed by the president. So let that sink in.
Right.
To become a federal judge, the president appoints you.
Wow.
Secondly, they serve for life. That means they never have to go before the electorate. Now, a federal judge is an incredibly powerful person. Mm-hmm. Okay. Because the district courts, and I'm speaking now about criminal mm-hmm. judges, because I don't really know about civil judges. Mm-hmm. So they can never be challenged. They can only step down if they want to, and they're appointed by the president. So consequently, there tends to be kind of an even split. Mm. And whenever journalists write about judges, they always say a Reagan appointee, mm-hmm. a Carter appointee, mm-hmm. right? Trump is actually well known for stacking the U.S. Supreme mm-hmm. Court with conservative judges. And keep in mind, there's been allegations of misconduct, right? Conflicts of interest. Mm-hmm. But the Supreme Court judges don't have to get elected, right? Right. They serve for life.
Right. So what is your view? But they're not litigating criminal trials.
No, but they rule on criminal issues.
Right. Right. So do you think that's a good thing, or do you think that's a bad thing that they rule for life and they're essentially dictators?
I mean, it kind of goes both ways, right? If I like a judge like Ruth Ginsburg, mm. then I want her to serve mm. for life, right?
Yeah.
If I don't like a judge, then
you want her to die.
I'd rather
also like Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
I mean, yeah, there's the RBG joke. Right. So the answer is that sometimes there's a benefit to having to face the electorate.
Yeah.
Right. But again, like I said before, in criminal justice, things that sound good initially sometimes go the other way. Mm-hmm. So it sounds good that a judge every 4 years has to go before the electorate, right? It sounds like accountability. Mm-hmm. But like I said, a lot of judges are former prosecutors.
Right. And that causes them to be more political. And that's what you don't want in a judge, is someone who's political.
So there's a big issue right now with the District Attorney of Los Angeles, George Gascon. I think he's got 23 challengers. Mm-hmm. And I know some of his challengers very well. I've done cases with them. We're on a first name basis. We're cordial, et cetera. So the district attorney also faces the electorate, and there's a big issue with the LA County DA. But what I'm saying is that when you run for district attorney as a former prosecutor, ultimately you may end up running for judge. So what's interesting about that is that's kind of the career path, mm-hmm. former DA, 10 years, tough on crime, mm-hmm. gang prosecutor. Now I'm running for judge. I'm going to keep the community safe, mm-hmm. et cetera. So remember when I talked about having relationships with district attorneys?
Yeah.
I do that naturally, but remember, you do a case. I have two sex crime DAs who are now judges. So I get to say, I don't call them by their first name, but I say, hey, Your Honor, right? And then they know me. Mm-hmm. So your prosecutor that you deal with today could be running for judge tomorrow.
Right.
And I'm just thinking about it. I've got a bunch of DAs I've dealt with who are running for judge or district attorney.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And so you want to be, just like any job, you want to be friendly with the competition, because you might need evidence that needs to get suppressed. And a lot of times that just is a judge's decision. Do you think the system now is less racist, more racist, or the same as it was back, you know, 1990s and previous?
I think overall it's less, mm-hmm. but it's kind of like the lawyer answer, define racism. So I'll give you a couple scenarios. In the early 2000s, the California prison system had about, even in 2010, 160,000 inmates. That was about, I want to say the ideal population is about 120 or 130,000. Mm. So if you're looking for, quote, institutional racism, and you look at the California population demographics at large, and you find that African Americans and Latinos are disproportionately represented in a prison population, then if that's what institutional racism is, I think it's gotten maybe a little better. Mm-hmm. And they've reduced the amount of inmates to about 120,000. Mm-hmm. If institutional racism has to do with juror bias, then they recently, so there's something called the Batson-Wheeler challenge. Mm-hmm. And what a Batson-Wheeler challenge means, let's say it's a black defendant, right? And there's five African-Americans in the box, and then there's like seven white people. Mm-hmm. So if the DA systematically kicks off every African-American juror, then defense, we're allowed to make a motion to the judge and say, Your Honor, they're clearly abusing their peremptory challenges on the basis of race.
But don't you do the same thing though, as when you're as on the defense picking a jury?
Right. So now the law, they amended the law to try to make it fair. Again, it sounds good. Mm-hmm. They put all this stuff in the penal code, but now the DAs can do it to us.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
So see what I'm saying? In criminal justice reform, things that sounded good end up playing out as being bad for the defendant or the defense.
I guess anecdotally, that's kind of what I'm asking. You know, the crack cocaine laws to me were the last real obvious law that had racial bias baked into it, right? Because most people selling crack are black, going to be black, and powder cocaine is everybody else. That's been since, it's not 100-1 anymore. It's like, I think 1-20 or something like that. Mm-hmm. But now meth, I think, is like 1-100. And a lot of people selling meth are white boys and Mexican. So I'm not really talking about that. I was talking about just like what you see like in people's hearts. Like, do you see people just accepting a defendant based on that person, based on the individual rather than their race? Do you see that improving?
Well, it's kind of a multi-layered answer. Mm-hmm. So jury selection, we call voir dire. And in voir dire, which basically means to ask questions in French, this is interesting. So in a jury trial, it's the one time where Rosenberg gets to go first. So defense, we can talk to the jury. And we're doing things like educating them. Proof beyond a reasonable doubt is a high standard, unlike civil.
Right.
We're trying to find biases that they may have. Are you a gun control nut? And my client's accused of shooting somebody. Will you automatically hold it against him?
You can ask direct questions like that?
Yeah. It's called voir dire, jury selection.
Right.
So it's supposed to be based upon the answer, right? If someone says, well, my uncle is serving life in prison, I believe he was treated unfairly, the prosecutor is going to kick that juror, right? But we have something we can do called a challenge for cause. And a challenge for cause means I can say, well, Your Honor, right? This person has admitted that they were robbed at gunpoint. And they've said that they'll try, but they don't really think they can be fair and impartial in this case. So based on that, I'm making a challenge for cause. I'm not burning one of my peremptory challenges. Peremptory challenge means I can make it for any reason. And in a life in prison case, I get 20 peremptory challenges. The DA gets 20. So you can see how already we might kick 40 people.
Yeah.
And we need 12 plus alternates in the jury.
How important is jury selection?
Oh,
it's like everything, right?
It's so if you pick the only part of the trial that I sometimes used to get nervous for was jury selection because, you know, it's kind of like loading film in your camera. If there's one little crack in the black tape, the entire film is ruined. So picking a bad jury is often the leading cause of a conviction.
Yeah. So how long can you spend? Is there a time limit?
Yeah. So the last judge where I just finished a trial and there's no verdict yet, and that was on Friday before I went to Alex's case, I closed and the DA closed. That judge gave us gave me 30 minutes for my initial voir dire, mm-hmm. and then 15 minutes for the new people.
That's it?
Who come in. Yeah.
30 minutes for the whole jury selection?
30 minutes for the first panel.
Right.
And then 15 minutes when a bunch of new people come in.
Wow. So do you already have the file on these people so you know what questions to ask them?
No, there's just standard questions that we ask.
Right. Right. But then you can, but then depending on who the nature of the case and who the, you know, if the case is a black guy killed a white guy, mm-hmm. and you went before my uncle Peter, my uncle got beat up. He got mugged in Ohio back in the '70s by a bunch of black dudes. Mm-hmm. So you would have specified questions prepared for this guy, right? Based off of who the defendant is.
The judge would likely, so the judge has his own questionnaire, right?
Right.
Occupation, how many adults mm-hmm. are in the house? What are their occupations? Have you been on a jury before?
Yeah.
Have you ever been arrested, convicted? Mm-hmm. Have you ever been a victim of crime?
Yeah.
So a lot of this comes out through that, but we're able to ask our own questions.
Right.
So I might say something like, prospective juror number four, you mentioned that you served on a civil trial and you, as the judge has told you, the standard of proof here is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Would you be able to apply that standard to this case for my client?
Mm.
And then they're going to say, yeah, but then there might be another answer they give where I tell the judge, Your Honor, I want to kick that person for cause because this is why.
Right. So you're looking, you have to be reading between the lines. Just because they say yes on this question, you might ask them another question that kind of either confirms that they were telling the truth or you're looking for contradiction.
A common question in every jury selection is, will you give a law enforcement officer more credibility simply because they're an officer?
Yeah.
And I've asked questions like, now, prospective juror so-and-so. And remember, this is the only time when I get to talk. Mm-hmm. As soon as the evidence starts, as soon as we pick a jury, we can't contact them at all. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that means no good morning in the elevator.
Right. Right.
Okay. I've had jurors talk to me. One guy asked me where I buy my suits and I looked at him and I just went mm-hmm. like that.
Yeah.
Cause that could be misconduct.
Yeah.
Basis of a new trial.
Do you ever have people, you know, the big funny stereotype is if you get called down for jury duty, you can just say I'm racist and they'll dismiss you. Do you ever get people that say, I don't like Mexicans. It is what it is. Do you ever get that?
I haven't had that here in Southern California, but I'll tell you a little bit more about how it works to flesh mm-hmm. it out. So the judge has the interest of not kicking jurors because they don't want to lose jurors.
Why?
They want to get the panel seated quick.
Right.
They want the trial over quick.
Mm-hmm.
And so when jurors start giving these answers, the judge will try to, quote, rehabilitate them. And then it gets even worse. The judge will make comments to us like, juror number five is just trying to get off of jury service. And that my last judge, he talked about doctors. So doctors notoriously want to get off a jury.
Right.
Because they're losing money.
Yeah, of course.
And I once subpoenaed an endocrinologist for a trial that I had. The issue was hypothyroidism. Mm. I forget why it was relevant. But she looked at me. I drove to her office and dropped it off. And I talked to her. And she basically said, Rosenberg, on that day, I have a surgery that's worth $20,000.
Yeah.
So she never came, even though I subpoenaed her.
And technically she could be arrested?
Technically, but they rarely do it. Oh, here's a funny story. When I was in Tulare County, so the judge will order a panel. Let's say there's 30 people, right? Okay. And then we go through all our challenges, like a misdemeanor. We get 10, they get 10. So that's 20. So now there's 10 people and we're out of jurors.
Yeah.
So the law is that the judge can have the bailiff go out in the community and basically say, you have jury duty right now. Come with me.
That's crazy.
Right?
That's like some old school Wild West.
So they've done that
shit.
In Tulare County. They did that.
So now you have jurors that don't want to be there.
Nobody wants to be
there. Isn't that good for the defense though? When you have a jury, like I've talked to people that have been on juries that where the evidence was overwhelming against the defendant, but they were like, I can't do this. I have to get back to my family. And they've just voted not guilty. Like, don't you think that's an advantage to the defense that right. most jurors just want to get it over with?
So I'll go back to the 7 week long trial that we talked about. And basically, the government, as they're called, bored the shit out of that jury.
Right.
Okay. They did. So like I said, I try to be animated, get in, yeah. get what I need and get out. Yeah. And I think, when I do that in my closing, I have a slide of a clock and I basically say, ladies and gentlemen, defense has respected your time. And I have found that that wow. can be an effective thing that they know Rosenberg did not waste your time.
Wow. Literally, you're just making them like you more than the other yeah. side. And that could be enough for, because all you need on a murder or a criminal case is one person to vote not guilty, right? Mm-hmm. Wow. Now, I want to get back to a few more things that you said, particularly about the judge. He's the one that wants the trial to get over the quickest. Why is that? I mean, I can speculate right. on the reasons why, because he's playing with, you know, taxpayer money, but does he have pressure from above?
Yes.
Okay. Go into that, please.
Okay. So in some counties, they don't really jam you up if you get continuances and cases get old,
uh-huh.
right? Sometimes they kind of like it because you get to build a rapport and, you know, mm-hmm. this case again. But in Los Angeles County, there are marching orders. And a misdemeanor case is supposed to be done within 90 days. And a federal case is supposed to be done in 120 days. So okay. part of my practice is defending Rosenberg. Why is this case 3 years old?
Right.
So they have high caseloads.
Yeah.
They have to move it along. Mm-hmm. And the presiding judge is tracking their numbers.
Okay. So a presiding judge is like that, the judge's boss.
Yeah. The PJ we call it.
Right. Right.
So they get stats.
Yeah.
So every case that comes up in LA County says, here's the arraignment date. It's this old and here's what's going on. Mm-hmm. And it's set for pretrial.
Yeah.
And I have judges say all the time, Rosenberg, you're either going to settle this case or I'm sending you to trial.
Wow.
A lot.
And
they want the trials to go quickly so that they don't bore the jurors.
Yeah.
Remember, who are the jurors again? They vote for judges, right?
Right. Right. Wow. Now, do you think that incentive, do you think that's part of the reason that they threaten people? Like, you have everybody who gets arrested, everybody, no matter how obviously guilty or not, has the constitutional right to go to trial.
Mm-hmm.
The burden of proof is not on them. It's on the state to why you are guilty. You do not have to prove yourself innocent. Everybody has the right to go to trial. Obviously, if that were the case in practice, the whole system would collapse. People would be waiting years to get their day in court. That's part of the reason they say that if I'm a defendant, you're the prosecution, you offer me 10 years, I take it to trial and I lose, I get 30, right? Even though I just did what was my right. Do you think the reason that they give you so much more time, if you don't take their plea deal, you go to trial and you lose, it's because of the backlog in the system? Do you think it's consciously that is the reason, is because they want to incentivize people to just quickly go through, you know, take your plea and keep it moving? Do you think sure. that's the reason they do it?
So we call that trial tax.
Mm.
And trial tax means the prosecutor made you an offer before preliminary hearing. If you don't take it, that offer is withdrawn.
Right.
After preliminary hearing, it's going to be a worse offer. But remember, I get better offers after preliminary hearing all the time by pointing out the weaknesses in their case.
Right.
But then the DA, the judge will say, you know, whatever. Mrs. Smith, was there an offer extended in this case? And the DA will say, yes, Your Honor, we offered 12 years, but defendant rejected it. Mm-hmm. So then some judges will say now, Rosenberg's client, you realize that if you lose at trial, you could get up to a maximum of 45 years, and you've rejected a 12-year offer. And I've seen judges talk to defendants like that. But what happens is, once the judge knows all that and the defendant still goes to trial, mm-hmm. It used to be they could max somebody out, and they changed the law on that. So determinate sentences in California are what we call, they're tripartite. So there's low term, mid term, and high term. Mm. And nowadays, in order for the prosecutor to ask the judge for high term, they have to prove what we call aggravating factors. Mm. So recently it's been a change. So now the DAs allege all these factors. Mm. By alleging all these factors and they get proven at trial, then the judge can max you out. So the chances of getting a maxed out sentence can go up. Remember what I said, it sounds good at first. Mm. They have to allege all these factors and they have to be proven before you can get maxed out, but they just go ahead and do it.
Right.
So that's a form of trial tax. As you said, look, if every, okay, so I have the statistics. A few years ago in LA County, there were 200,000 felonies filed.
In 1 year.
And yeah. And it feels like 3 or 4 years ago when Gascon came in, the number went down to 91,000. Mm-hmm. Okay. But if all 91,000 defendants asked for a trial with no time waivers, then the whole thing would blow up. Mm-hmm. They'd have to dismiss, but then they can refile.
Right.
But you see what I'm saying? Right. So the public defenders, every now and then, they get ornery.
Yeah.
And they start setting everything for trial to say, F you people.
Right.
We have power too.
Right, right.
And an aside to that is the San Francisco public defender. So me and Adachi were actually really good friends. I worked on his campaign. So there was a time when the public defender in San Francisco said, we're unavailable. Our people have too many cases, so you cannot give us any more cases. Now that disrupted the criminal justice system.
And you know who that's good for? The people that are out on bail. Mm-hmm. If you're stuck fighting your case from the inside, you don't want that to happen, even though it sounds good, because then, hey, guess what? Your trial date just went from 6 months from now to 4 years from now. I actually read, I'm not sure how true this is, but I heard that in India, country of India, there's so few lawyers compared to the number of defendants that you could get caught shoplifting and be in jail for 10 years.
Wow.
Just waiting because it's so backlogged.
But they don't have speedy trial rights.
Probably not. I don't know. I don't know what kind of rights they have in India. But yeah, that's really interesting though. I wonder like if... I feel like lawyers now or inmates, defendants who, get the trial tax and a judge tells them, you know, they have it on record that the judge was like, hey, if you don't take 10, you're going to get 50. I feel like you could appeal that on constitutional basis, right? Of a cruel and unusual punishment or no? What do you think?
Well, so the answer to that is it goes back to the legislature. Mm-hmm. Right. The judges, the judicial branch is part of the executive branch.
Yeah.
So is the district attorney
and
the cops. But the legislature is the one that votes and says human trafficking is 5 years, 8 years, or 12 years.
Yeah.
They're the ones that say, and that's a strike. So when the judge, let's say, has 5, 8, and 12, and there's aggravating factors, the judge heard the trial. And the judge has emotions. Mm-hmm. And so it's not unforeseeable that you'll get the 12.
Right. And that's on the books. So, but you know, do you have a lot of appeal cases? Do you win appeals?
So I don't do post-conviction relief.
Okay.
I have one case. It's a great case, prison gang evidence, very high profile case from the 90s. Mm-hmm. And I did write an appeal with my legal research lawyer, the guy who did People versus Neil Del Rio. Mm. That's my hot shot.
Yeah.
And so I worked on that case for 5 years.
Yeah.
And I found a recanting witness who said that the cops at Hollenbeck Station made me say that it was Rosenberg's client and I didn't see this and this was all a lie.
Yeah.
Okay. So I got a judge to, quote, issue an order to show cause. Mm-hmm. That means that what he said is that if everything Rosenberg said is true, his client can get a new trial. So most writs lose, summarily denied.
Yeah.
So I have one, as we say, you know, estamos en la jugada.
Yeah.
We're in the game. And it's possible I'll get him a new trial.
Wow.
If he gets a new trial, that will be legendary status.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm closer.
Do you get written? Do you get hit up by people in prison?
Yeah.
You must.
Sure.
You get calls on your phone still that you don't know how they got your number. Like, how do you like mitigate? How do you maintain some of your own privacy? Cause you're like a legend in the street, you know?
Well, my privacy is, you know, people recognize me. I was at a restaurant the other day. This guy crossed the room to come up to me. He's like, "You're Rosenberg." And so what I learned from, I grew up around famous people, and I know not to be a dick, but who really taught me how to be famous like that is Kat Von D and Conejo. Mm-hmm. And so I was there at a party and I saw Kat Von D and we're talking, but I said, "Hey, Kat, do you mind if I take a picture?" And she said, "Of course." And so I learned that that's how you want to be. You want to stay humble, as big, as well-known as you get. You know, the homies can come up to you, homie hug, you want a flika, whatever it is.
Do you ever worry about dissatisfied clients? I remember my buddy who I grew up with, his dad was a criminal defense lawyer and they went to trial and they blew trial, guilty. The defendant turned and just punched his dad, like knocked him out. Have you ever had like a really angry, guilty client that maybe wanted to hurt you or was just super pissed off at you?
So most of my clients, win, lose, or draw, know that I'm putting in work.
Yeah.
I'm working up the case. And I had a client who told me, you know, Rosenberg, I chose this life. I might have to do time. Right. But if he knows that I investigated the case, I worked it up, I have a defense, this is what it is, and I did a good job in trial, then that's what they want. That's why my motto is punching back. Because so many people said my lawyer didn't do shit. He didn't fight for me. He just did what the DA said.
Yeah.
It's all corrupt.
You talked about how important it is that your clients listen to you. Mm-hmm. You won't take people that aren't going to, you know, treat it like a team effort.
Yeah.
Have you ever had to like override a client? Can you tell us an instance where a client wanted it one way and you said, no, we're going to take it to trial or we're going to plea. Like, do you have to do that a lot?
So in my practice, I try to give options. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I'm blessed. I pick clients and cases. I represent people who are well known in their respective communities, the rappers, and they know the work that I can do. And so I try to deliver. Mm-hmm. But again, I wish I could say, give Rosenberg a couple racks and I know we're going to win for sure.
Yeah.
It's guaranteed. It's actually unethical for an attorney to offer a guarantee like that.
Of course.
Because people come to me, no offense, but they're desperate, right? They're in trouble.
Yeah.
And as the lawyer, I can take advantage of that. Mm-hmm. So it's in my retainer. I'm not offering any guarantees, but it says I will pursue the case with care and attempt to achieve the goals of client.
Do you take money from, you don't know that they're drug dealers, but smart drug dealers will retain an attorney way before they ever get arrested. Do you have clients that just come to you with $20,000 and say, "Hey, I hope you never see me again. But if you do, my name is Johnny Mitchell and you're mine and I'm yours." Do you have people that do that?
So I don't do monthly retainers. What I do tell people is save my number. Mm. If you are under investigation, contact me immediately. Mm. And if you get arrested, I have no statement. I want my lawyer. Don't talk in the tank. I can arrange for bail. So I do a lot of pre-arrest representation mm-hmm. where I basically tell the cops, I'm the lawyer. My client has no statement and he doesn't want to talk without a lawyer. If you feel you have probable cause to arrest my client, contact me. I'll arrange a station surrender. And I've shut down. I've shut down attempted murder, kidnapping, vehicular manslaughter, because again, this is the most dangerous thing in a criminal case is what comes out of your mouth. Right. And it's the only thing that we can really control.
Right. Of course. Do you take cash?
Some of my clients pay me in cash. The way the world is now is I just get Zelled.
Yeah. Is there a maximum you could accept at a time, or do you have to declare all like a big lumps of cash that come in?
So what I do is I just put it in the bank.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And like I said, I have a corporation, so I have a lot of overhead.
Yeah.
I was telling Brian, I have bus benches all around CCB.
Nice.
So the sheriff, right? Robert Luna, who, by the way, I did a fundraiser for him. He knows me. I know him. And the district attorneys have to go right by my billboard every morning. So consequent, and judges, you know, rib me about that because I used to have arrested, hire a fighter where I'm in boxing trunks, no shirt.
Yeah.
So they know who I am.
So, but I'm saying like, is there any ethical problems? You know, I used to bring my lawyer, I meet him at a diner and I would slip him envelopes with $20,000. Clearly it's drug money. These are not like crisp hundreds from the bank. They smell like weed and cocaine. Like, are there any problems with accepting money like that?
So in the feds, sometimes they have done, like asset seizures, but the last attorney general in Los Angeles, I think it's Nicolo Hanna. Mm-hmm. I forget who the new chief is, but basically they have said that they're not going to do that.
Okay.
But again, you know, an attorney like me, I'm under scrutiny. They know who I am. Mm. So I have to run a squeaky clean program.
Tight ship, or else you might have feds looking into you. Have you ever thought about that? Do you ever think like the FBI, you know, because you are surrounded by a lot of criminals, people that break the law. Do you ever suspect that you might be under investigation?
I was in 2014.
Really?
And my joke is I saw the F-150s.
Yeah, right.
And that was the time frame when they were investigating that other lawyer who ended up getting indicted.
Right. And that's because what was that case again? Who were you surrounded by?
That was a
by?
RICO for extortion inside the jail.
Right.
The dirty thirds.
Right.
But I caught a special agent tailing me and he came up. I took a picture of him from behind and he got pissed. But he came up to me once when I was walking downtown and he said, I gotcha.
Did that scare the shit out of you?
No.
Or did you just tell him to get the fuck out of here? What would you say to that?
It's like, whatever, bro. Follow me.
Yeah.
See where I go.
Right.
Right?
Wow.
Go ahead. Bring it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's wild. That's some Better Call Saul shit right there.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, bro, I need to operate with a squeaky, clean
tight
program.
Ship. Yeah. Because you got a target on you. Damn. I had one more question for you.
You were going to talk about the Sancho?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, you're a single guy. So I was asking, I'm saying you must be getting hit on by all of these now single women whose mans are, you know, doing life without parole.
So the answer to that is women hire me, mom, grandmom, aunt, girlfriend, wife.
Right.
So now there are guys that come in, but mostly it's the women cause they're helping out their loved one, but I cannot be a Sancho. If I'm a Sancho,
and let's define Sancho for our square listeners.
So Sancho is the guy who's having sex with your girl while you're in jail, prison, detention.
Doing time. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a no bueno. That's a no brainer.
Right.
Oh, and I'll tell you that right now, if you have sex with a client, you can get disbarred.
Right. That probably makes sense.
It's a newer rule.
Right.
So that's another pitfall.
Well, you know the story about Griselda. Is that for active clients? You know this.
So that's a good question. I would probably want to read an administrative decision from the state bar about former clients.
Right, former clients. That's probably all right. I don't know. But
you had a story. Who's Griselda?
Oh, Griselda Blanco. They've got a Netflix series on her right now. One of the most famous drug queenpins of all time. She had so, if you go watch the Cocaine Cowboys from 2006, Billy Corbin, I just spoke with her only surviving son today on the phone, Michael. We're trying to get him on the podcast, but she had so many bodies on her, like it make your head spin, right? She was a monster. She killed every one of her husbands or ex-husbands. They finally caught up with her. They arrested her in like 88, 89, federal trial, right? They wanted to give her the federal death penalty, right? They found out that the prosecuting attorney, his secretary was having phone sex with one of the key co-defendants in the trial. And it was such a scandal. They gave her 20. Wow. They gave her a fucking plea deal. She saw the streets again after that. So yeah, it gets weird. And I think the lady who's trying to prosecute Trump for election fraud in Georgia.
Yeah.
It just came out.
Fannie Willis?
Yes. She was fucking, somebody involved in the case. Right.
Yeah.
People just do that. People
That's
shit.
Embarrassing.
It's embarrassing. People shit where they eat. They were like, how?
Oh, I got a story on that.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to name names, but I know the names. In San Fernando, there was a younger district attorney who started having sex with a gang detective. And the reason it came to light is that she sued the county for sexual harassment and gave a deposition. So once the district attorney knew about that, they had to investigate. So they started dismissing cases.
Wow, that he had been involved in.
Yeah, he and her.
He and her, wow. Right. Can you imagine that? You're sitting, you got caught, you got guilty, found guilty for a murder. You're sitting in Cochrane doing life and you just get a knock on your door. Hey, roll up.
Yeah.
You talk about a lottery ticket.
Just so you know, we say Corcoran.
Corcoran.
Yeah. When they have a shoe in Corcoran, shoe is secured housing unit.
Yeah.
Basically solitary confinement.
Yeah. Yeah. That's wild. Last question. So you just finished up a trial for, a man who was involved in a robbery turned into a homicide of a dispensary. And, you gave your closing arguments. Trial lasted about 2 weeks.
I want to say 2, 3, 6, maybe 6 or 7 court days.
Yeah. Yeah. So, he's facing, he had a plea deal for 28 to life. If he blows trial, he'll probably do the rest of his life in prison, 50 to life.
Well, he's a youthful offender.
Oh,
wow. So he will get a parole date at least at 25 years.
Right. Okay. So if he survives in that time, he's going to face hell when he goes, he's going to be involved. California prisons are level 4 and 3 and 4. Yeah, his life's over basically, right? If he blows. How do you feel when you walk in on the day they announce the verdict? How do you feel before the jury foreman reads it? Like, what's going through your mind?
So I'm a Zen lawyer.
Yeah.
And it's another stage of the proceedings.
Right.
My client, his heart is racing.
Of course.
Right. If my heart's racing, then I lose professional credibility.
Yeah.
So what I do is I sit there, I have my trial notebook, and I write down count 1, count 2, count 3, NG, 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 G. Mm. And then I look up at the jury, and it's not personal. I don't mad dog them, but I'm going to reach over to my client. We're going to talk. The jury will be excused. And then the judge will say, if you want to talk to the lawyers, you can stick around. If it's guilt, they don't want to talk to me. But when it's not guilty, they kind of come up and they say, hey, you guys did a great job.
Wow.
And we get that juror feedback.
If it is guilty, what do you say? You know, if your client is found guilty, right? Mm-hmm. Next week or whenever, however long it takes them to deliver. What do you say to them?
I say, look, you can appeal it. There may be a legal error. I made a motion for a mistrial during the prosecution's closing argument because they kept saying defense, defense, defense. And I said, objection, Your Honor, ad hominem, motion for mistrial. So I end up making mistrial motions in almost all of my trials, mm-hmm. not because it's some kind of gamesmanship, but because I think they do something that's out of line.
Yeah.
And I've had them granted, remember?
Mm-hmm.
So I've gotten mistrials. In this case, they want to add a special circumstance, murder committed during a robbery.
Right.
So I don't want a mistrial because then they'll pick up 2 months and they can add it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not in my client's interest to file an appeal.
Right.
And if he files an appeal, they can add the special circumstance, which means life without parole.
Right. Right. So you're hoping, what are you hoping for?
I'm hoping for an acquittal on the murder,
mm-hmm.
acquittal on the attempt murder because of lack of evidence of planning.
Yeah.
And no first degree murder, premeditation, willfulness, or deliberation. And he's going to go down on the robbery.
Right.
Because he admitted to taking the security guard's gun.
Right. So it's going to be a robbery. What about manslaughter?
So I couldn't get that instruction.
Mm.
I tried. Now, remember, that could be an appealable issue.
Right.
But if it comes back in 2 years on appeal, depending on who's in the district attorney's office, I don't want them to file a special circ.
Mm.
We say special circ, special yeah. circumstance.
Sure. Wow. I mean, that's just so, it's so harrowing from the outside. Like just watching, sometimes I just watch, verdicts being read on YouTube and it just mm-hmm. makes my palms sweat.
Right.
You
know, I'll say that there was, you know, whenever, okay, so here's my little pitch about what I do. So they don't make shows about insurance salesmen, right? Mm. The shows are all about crime, mm. justice, criminal justice, lawyers, judges, whatever it is. So everyone's interested in what I do. Everyone thinks they know about the law
mm-hmm.
because they've had a civics class, they have their morality, et cetera. But the reality is what I do, nobody really knows, okay? It's kind of like magic in a way. And the lawyers, we know what it is, mm. but to lay people, and you can be a sophisticated, oh, that's another reason why I like the gangsters. They're sophisticated consumers of my service.
Mm-hmm.
They know about all the horrible things that happened.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm able to win them over, you know, yeah. that's a big win.
Would you call what you do art?
I do. It's called the practice of law, but it's an art because, you know, I've got to read a juror
mm-hmm.
in 30 seconds to find out, am I going to kick this person or not?
Right.
Is this someone I would have dinner with?
Yeah.
And if the answer is no, and I'm getting a lot of, you know, negative vibes, mm-hmm. I'm likely to kick them.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why the most artistic people are generally on the defense rather than the prosecution.
Right. Being a prosecutor is fairly easy because the cops do the investigation. You get the case, the law is on your side.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, you can kind of be on autopilot.
Yeah.
Having said that, you know, there are DAs that I respect that mm-hmm. I know who are great lawyers.
Yeah.
And I welcome doing a trial with them.
Mm. Do you recall some wins, like, you know, big life in prison cases?
Yeah.
Where the guy, you've gotten not guilty across the board and they've walked that day.
Yeah. So I talked about the Florencia gang murder yeah. by firearm with DNA.
Yeah.
After sentencing, he was processed and got let out. And he's actually a rapper. He used to go by Sonny Smooth. Now he goes by Sonny Road Runner.
Mm.
I did a pilot for my podcast with him.
Wow.
And when he got out, I knew he was into music. So I brought him to a rap show. When he got out, he had like this 25-year-old car, no money, right? But Rosenberg took him to the rap show to go see Gavlin because I wanted to try to like get him in the mix.
Wow. After 4 years.
He's a friend.
He was 4 years fighting his case, right?
Yeah. He's a friend.
Man.
So once you're in the Rosenberg familia, you're in for life.
Yeah. Yeah. Blood in, blood out.
Well, you know, that kind of to me means something different. But what I'm saying is, you know, my clients, I don't burn people.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're good.
Yeah. What a fascinating life you lead.
Thank you. Good, appreciate sir. That.
Thank you for coming on. This episode is going to do great. And I know that, you know, you've just got more good coming to you. So best of luck. And we will absolutely have dinner sometime. Rosenberg, thank you again. Follow him on Instagram. Hit him up if you're getting in trouble. You know, check him out. Podcast, all that. Patreon. Thank you, guys. We will see you next week.
All right. Thanks all right. for having me. You I'm blessed.
It. That's absolutely right. Peace out.